You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning and good afternoon and good evening to those of who are joining from outside the Washington area. My name is Suzanne Maloney. I'm the Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. It's our pleasure to welcome you on behalf of the program and our Center for Middle East Policy to today's event on Iraqi-U.S. relations under changing U.S. administrations. This morning's discussion of the relationship between Iraq and the United States comes as the administrations in both countries mark important milestones. The Biden administration has just completed its first 100 days in office, and Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khadami has reached his first anniversary in office. On April 7th, the two governments held their first strategic dialogue of the Biden administration, discussing topics including bilateral security cooperation, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the protection of democracy and freedom of speech. As is often the case, there are signs of opportunity and progress in Iraq and the region, but also developments, even today, that highlight the perils still facing the country and the region. For that reason, we are especially excited to have such a wonderful lineup of speakers today to examine the course of the relationship between Iraq and the United States. I'm delighted to welcome Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, Joey Hood, who in his keynote remarks will provide the Biden administration's view of this important relationship. Before taking on his current responsibilities in January, Acting Assistant Secretary Hood served as Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs from 2019 to 2021. He has held assignments throughout the Middle East during his career with the State Department, including as Deputy Chief of Mission in Iraq from 2017 to 2019. Following his remarks, we have an excellent panel scheduled to join us here today. I'm thrilled to welcome to the Brookings virtual stage Abbas Qadim, who is the director of the Iraq Initiative and resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Joining him from Baghdad is our very own Marcin Ashamari, who is a postdoctoral fellow here at Brookings Foreign Policy. And finally, moderating our panel today is Louisa Lovelock, who is the Baghdad bureau chief at the Washington Post. With that, I'll turn the mic over to Assistant Secretary Hood for his remarks. Welcome and look forward to hearing what you have to say to us today. Thank you so much.
Great. Well, thank you, Suzanne. Can you hear me okay? All right. That's the way of the pandemic, I suppose. Well, it's great to be here, especially today as we just get ready for Eid and we come back from a trip to the region, including Baghdad and Erbil. So it's great. It's good to see you, Suzanne. It's good to see Dr. Abbas and Louisa as well. It's excellent timing because not only was I on that trip, but our new counselor in the department, Derek Chalet, was on the trip as well. Brett McGurk, who is no stranger to those who follow Iraq, as well as Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Middle East at the Defense Department, Dana Struhl. And, I guess if I could just say one thing about the trip, it felt like a new honeymoon. It was very positive. We had a lot of optimism coming out of those meetings. I guess that's just the way it is in Iraq. A lot of times when you look at it from the outside, you think, oh, it looks so depressing. It's impossible. And then you get there and you talk to people who really have a lot of hope for their country, and it's hard to not support them. Marcin, I know you're interested in the question of individuals versus institutions. I don't know if my answers here are going to be at all helpful to you, because like a good diplomat or an economist, I guess I would say it all depends. Our relationship with Iraq is always going to be important, regardless of who is in power. The success of a country, as we know, is built on its institutions, but leadership really matters, as we've seen in our country and others around the world. So what I thought I would talk to you about today is what the United States government has been doing and is doing now to help build Iraq's institutions so that they are sustainable and they are ready to serve the Iraqi people under the right leadership. First of all, let me address one thing and move it off the table. There has been so much focus on a couple of thousand U.S. military forces in Iraq to the detriment of talking about every other aspect of our relationship. Our relationship goes far beyond just that security cooperation. It's really important. We've got to continue fighting together to keep Daesh at bay and hopefully completely defeated someday. And the presence of U.S. forces and coalition forces is really important to do that as they work with their Iraqi partners. And they've gotten really good at doing this together. We should get out of the way and let them do that. The question then becomes, what do you do once you have relative security from threats from Daesh, from ISIS? Well, it's sort of, if you think of it as building something together, that just lays the foundation. The question is, what kind of house or what kind of building are we going to build on top of that that foundation? And that's where we need to talk about the healthcare system, economic growth, expanding education and cultural ties so that more Iraqis and more Americans have connections to each other, they have better jobs, they have reasons to hope. I don't think that gets enough attention, so I want to talk about that a little bit today. One of the areas we're very active in, as many of you know, is stabilization, helping rebuild those communities that were devastated by ISIS. We've helped restore essential services, help displaced people, millions of them, get home. That's a big success story. Not everybody is home, and that's a cause for concern. But millions have returned home, and we need to recognize that. The ability for these people to go home and rebuild their lives is a huge component of preventing the conditions that allowed for ISIS to arise in the first place. That's why we are the largest donor to the UN Development Program's funding facility for stabilization. Since 2015, we have funded the rehabilitation of over 130 schools, 57 health clinics, 62 water treatment plants, and 17 electricity substations, as well as 3 major hospitals. The great likelihood, if you are living in an area liberated from Daesh, your water, your electricity, your school, your health clinic probably came back to life thanks to funding from the United States government and the U.S. taxpayer. When I was in Baghdad, we also helped announce some much-needed assistance for the Ibn al-Khatib Hospital, which, as we all know, was badly damaged in a fire and more than 80 people died. It's a small amount, but I think this is the kind of thing that we need to be doing going forward. We need to be working on those institutional strengthening. We need to be strengthening institutions, of course, whether that's buildings or training people and professionals, but we also need some quick assistance at times when there are disasters like this. In the health space, we've also, through our Defense Department, supported the Iraqi Ministry of Health's Field Epidemiology Program. That has helped renovate and equip 24 laboratory suites across the Iraqi government, and just in time, too, of course, with the pandemic upon us. We also have, through USAID, a program that doesn't get talked about a lot, but it works with provincial governments to try to improve performance and accountability for those governments that and those leaders in those governments that actually want to bring better services to their people. So we work on things that aren't really that sexy: water supply, solid waste management, electricity. But listen, if you're in Western Anbar, one of the driest regions of Iraq, you may now have a reliable water supply depending on where you live because of this program. We also have supported the Iraqi government in developing standard bidding procedures, and those have been used for more than 400 capital investment projects. Those have gone relatively well and relatively transparently. It's not big news, but that's 400 projects that aren't going to be as vulnerable to the type of corruption and other problems that we've seen because of these standards we've helped put in place. Again, that's not going to get headline news, but it's really, really important in helping build the institutions to get services to the Iraqi people. A couple more things, but one thing that really is exciting to me is the Development Finance Corporation, which is a new U.S. government entity that is able to help finance projects like the Pearl Petroleum gas expansion project in the Hormuz gas field in the Kurdistan region. That project, it's like $250 million that we're helping to provide the financing for. It's expected to help reduce the region's frequent blackouts and support the use of natural gas over heavy diesel and oil-fired generation, which will decrease CO2 emissions substantially. We are also, in Iraq, the embassy there receives the third largest public diplomacy budget of any of our embassies anywhere in the world. And because of that, we've been able to fund a huge number of cultural preservation and educational projects. For example, since 2017, we've funded the Smithsonian Institution's Nimrud Rescue Project to help salvage the ancient site of Nimrud, which was, as you know, demolished by ISIS. So far, that project has photographed, tagged, cleaned, and stored over 8,000 architectural fragments. I was there myself a couple of years ago to announce another installment of $1 million funding project for the restoration of the tomb of the Prophet Nahum in Al-Kosh. That's nearing completion now. This has a lot to do with institutions because we're, for every project that we fund, that's archaeologists, that's students who are able to get this important training and get those important connections to professionals and experts from the Western world. One more thing about education. Before the pandemic, we had more than 1,200 Iraqi students studying in the United States, and we look forward to welcoming more back after COVID-19. Through the Liberated Universities Initiative, we're also helping to rebuild universities in Mosul, Tikrit, Fallujah, and Anbar. And since 2007, we've had a youth leadership exchange program that has brought more than 3,500 Iraqis from the ages of 15 to 22 to the United States for an intensive 4-week summer exchange. Some of those people now are running non-governmental organizations. They are entering the Iraqi military as officers, or they're doing things like fighting fires. You know, when the embassy was attacked in December 2019 and January 1st of 2020, it was chaos out in front of the embassy. But one of the entities that came and really helped us was the Baghdad Fire Department. Why? Because we had brought them to the United States. We had welcomed them for Thanksgiving dinner in people's homes. We'd trained together and we worked with them week in and week out with our own little fire department at the embassy to help whenever we would need them. And thank God they were there when we did. To help prevent a bigger disaster. We've got $10 million appropriated by Congress for the American University of Iraq in Sulaymaniyah. We've provided training to hundreds and hundreds of journalists, including members of smaller Iraqi components and women in Baghdad, Anbar, Nineveh, Salahuddin, the Kurdistan region. I could go on and on, but these are different parts of what we call the strategic relationship, which comes under the Strategic Framework Agreement. There's a tendency, I think, of some in the media and maybe in academia to think, oh, we just launched this strategic dialogue last year. Well, we didn't. That agreement's been around since 2008. And while we haven't always, quote unquote, activated it the way that some of our Iraqi friends would like us to do, this is the fourth U.S. administration using the same agreement and the same structure to try to move forward our strategic relationship. I think we have done a lot of things together. I think there's a lot more to do. And based on my visits to Baghdad and Erbil last week. I think there's a lot of optimism and willingness in the central government and the regional government to do more of this cooperation. So I will stop there and look forward to the discussion. I promise I'll be much shorter in the Q&A session.
Well, thank you, Assistant Secretary, for those remarks. To introduce myself, I'm Louisa Lovelock. I am the Washington Post's Bureau Chief here in Iraq, and I am delighted to be hosting this panel today. We have a great lineup. Of course, we have the Assistant Secretary, we have Dr. Marcin El-Shamri, we have Dr. Abbas Kadim, and I think it's going to be a great discussion. Marcin is a postdoctoral research fellow with the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. She's a non-resident fellow at the Institute of Regional and International Studies, at the American University of Iraq. And her research focuses on Iraqi politics, on the Iraqi-US relationship, and Shiite political activism. Dr. Abbas leads the Iraq Initiative within the Atlantic Council's Middle East Program. He is a long-standing Iraq expert and the author of Reclaiming Iraq, the 1920 Revolution, and the Founding of the Modern State. Now, I'm going to keep my housekeeping notes brief. We are slightly short on time. I'm going to first ask the panel to expand on the thoughts that Assistant Secretary Hood has outlined in his speech, especially after coming back from Baghdad. You know, you say you're witnessing a new honeymoon. And we're really going to be looking at questions of sort of how individuals or individual administrations can or indeed do change and shift US policy towards Iraq. President Biden may be a new face as the president, but much of his Iraq team has served across multiple administrations. They've been present for notable successes, particularly in the fight against ISIS, but they've also been present for policies that have drawn significant criticism. And I think that will be the basis of an interesting discussion today. We welcome your questions. In about 20 minutes, we're going to turn this over for that. If you have anything you'd like to say, please do email us at events@brookings.edu, I think that's what he said, or please tweet at us at the hashtag USIraq. So to get us started, I think one of the key challenges that the Biden administration has faced in its foreign policy right now, not just in the Middle East, but also in critical issues like environmental policy, is the fact that other states, particularly after this recent transition, have had maybe a harder time trusting the US to maintain its position in the long run past the tenure of an individual president. Marcin, I wonder, to what extent do you think the sentiment is, or this is a sentiment reflected by Iraqi policymakers? Is it a major concern? And is there anything that American policymakers can do about that?
Thank you, Louisa. I do think this is a problem we might be seeing with a lot of other states in terms of their interaction with the US, possibly because they've had experiences with the cyclical nature of the US administration. And so they've had experience with this, whereas Iraq, I think, has had relatively newer experiences with US administrations. I mean, our first experience post-2003 was obviously the Bush administration, which was quite unique. And then after that, the Obama administration came as a bit of a whiplash in that it was so different than anticipated. And following that, of course, the Trump administration was a different form of whiplash. And, you know, it was quite different than other Republican administrations and what Iraqis were expecting. So I think in a ironic way, Iraqis are used to changing U.S. administrations by now and have grown accustomed to this. I think with regards to the Biden administration, naturally, the closest comparison would be made to Obama. I think we've moved past the point of the cliche of, oh, President Biden wants to divide Iraq and all the Iraqis are worried about that. I think that we can set aside for now. But I do think the closest, you know, we've seen is the Obama administration in terms of both staff and in terms of this is the last time we've seen President Biden in similar roles and the like. But I don't think that would really impede any desire to interact with or to cooperate with the U.S. in any way. I don't know if Dr. Abbas Kadim has any additions to that.
I fully agree with you.
Assistant Secretary, you know, to what extent is that an experience that you are having right now? You know, a sense that there is a either a concern or a, you know, a lack of confidence that there will be that the policies in the next 4 years will endure beyond that. And to the extent that you're experiencing that, what can you do to overcome that?
Well, one thing that we can do is to travel to the region and to reassure our partners that we are remaining engaged. And that is what we've done. And when I say that it was sort of like a honeymoon, it's because they were really happy to hear that. And we were pleased to hear as well that many of the interests expressed by our Iraqi interlocutors dovetailed very well with what we see as U.S. interests, meaning a free and fair election in which the voices of the Iraqi people could be accurately reflected and fully reflected. We're going to support that as much as we can. Continuing the fight against ISIS, as we are invited by the Iraqi government to do so. And, you know, in terms of what the configuration and the number of our military forces there and coalition forces, that's being referred to experts, as we discussed at the last strategic dialogue, as it should be. And then talking about, you know, what kind of deals are we going to put in front of the Development Finance Corporation to get more financing for? Everyone was very happy to hear that. You know, this is what we should be talking about. How can we bring business delegations to the major cities to see what projects are going to be on tap after the restrictions of the pandemic have eased a little bit? These things, I would say, really haven't changed from one administration to another. Obviously, I'm not saying that administrations are all the same. They're not. We just heard that one president decided to invade Iraq, and another president might have decided to remove military forces. So elections do have consequences for all of our countries. But I think that what you can see is that broadly over the decades, there are different periods of U.S.-Iraqi relations. You can go back all the way to, you know, the beginning and see that generally for, you know, 20, 30 years, there is quite a bit of continuity until historical events move those in a different direction. And they're not always events that the United States controls or that Iraq controls, frankly. So I think that we just need to make sure that whatever we do, we have relationships institution to institution and people to people, university to university, so that no matter what the changes are at the political level or the geostrategic level, those connections will be able to bring our countries through to the next phase.
If I can just come back on that, I think certainly under President Trump, you know, we saw Iraq very much being sort of subordinated as a file to sort of sitting predominantly under the Iran file. You know, the Trump administration was very, I suppose, preoccupied with Iran's role in the region. And so Iraq often sort of fell maybe down the list as an individual focus. To what extent is that sort of, which is, I suppose, Iraq sitting slightly below Iran, kind of in the sort of policy pecking order, still an issue for the administration? And what discussions can you have with the Iraqis about this? You know, do they feel that they are sort of being treated with as one facet of the Iran policy, or did you feel that they actually saw that there was a separate emerging policy towards them?
Yeah, I mean, nobody wants to see Iraq as a battleground, at least not from our side. And no one who's serious in the Iraqi government wants to see that either. So, but to say that Iraq is somehow divorced from the rest of the region and is kind of like its own Switzerland, I think is not accurate either. It has been a major part of the region since, you know, time immemorial, and it will always remain so. And so we need to embrace that and help the Iraqi government to embrace that as well, which I think we've been doing with our support for conversations between different belligerents or adversaries in the region that Iraq has been able to bring together. That's great. You know, building ties between Iraq and the rest of the region, not just Iran, but with the Arab countries and with Turkey as well. Relations that are beneficial to Iraq, I think, is only going to help the country. We don't think that Iraq should never have a relationship with Iran. It should just be one based on Iraqi national interests and not those based exclusively on Iran's. So culture, education, trade, on a level playing field. These are all developments that I think we support. So Iraq as part of the region and as a critical convener of parties in the region, yes. Iraq as a battleground, no.
Thank you. Abbas, so of course you had this, this high-level delegation in Iraq last week, including the Assistant Secretary. One of the people on that delegation was Brett McGurk, obviously an individual who was served under Bush, under Obama, under Trump, and now under Biden. What does the fact that there are key individuals who have come back to Baghdad time and time again to have these conversations say to you about how American foreign policy is shaped in Iraq? And can it fundamentally change now?
Well, thank you very much. This is an important question. I think, first, to understand the role of people like Brett in this assignment, the U.S., the nature of U.S. administrations, normally it is a lot of people like Brett and others are there to implement the larger strategic plan, whatever the plan is from the administration's perspective. They are not there to make policy. They go there to perform their part in the overall policy. And but on the other hand, they have the power to give to feed their own experiences, their own views into the process. So they are important, but they are not the decision makers. And we saw different Bretts in different administrations. I wouldn't count Brett's role in the Bush administration as an important one. Brett's role became very important during the Obama administration. But later on with the Trump administration, he was, he served for a short time, then he resigned. And now he's back. So, I think it is, I wouldn't call this as a continuity, even though we would like to see continuity. You just mentioned earlier in the discussion about the Iran policy and how the individuals or institutions are the ones that affected the situation over Iraq versus Iran policy. And this is a great example of what we have seen. An individual, President Trump, can in fact steer institutions away from their long held institutional memory, if we were to call it that way. To create positive change, relations, to establish positive relations, you need institutions. But also individuals can be instrumental in ruining relations, because in the United States, the presidency has a huge scope of power. And this is kind of not probably our own scope of discussion. This goes into understanding how the U.S. System works. But the presidency over the years have acquired a lot of power, and the president himself can, in fact, rearrange the institutions the way he wishes them. One example I can cite in this sense, we always had an Iraq desk and an Iran desk under President Trump. They combined these under the same deputy assistant secretary. And because of the interest of the president and the secretary of state in Iran, these people were pretty much doing nothing but Iran. And then when they do Iraq, it's how does it fit in the overall Iran policy? Even things, small things like waivers for purchasing fuel from Iran came to be manipulated once they give them 60 days, 90 days, or 45 days, if there is a deadline within those 45 days to pressure the Iraqis to do something or the Iranians. So the whole situation here is that you can have people, you know, I mean, Joey is a great example. I know Joey. I have met him both in here in the United States and also in Iraq when he was leading, actually, the U.S. mission at the time between two ambassadors. And Joey, who is well-received in Iraq, who's really liked by every Iraqi politician and administrator I've spoken to. But sometimes you get situations where, you know, they really overwhelm everyone, even with the goodwill of the people. From the Iraqi side as well, I mean, I must say that U.S., and I will conclude with this, U.S.-Iraqi relations don't suffer from government-to-government animosities. In fact, the two governments are doing very well. Under Trump and under Biden administrations, they had three dialogues that were all amicable. The problem is that the prime minister in Iraq and the cabinet are not the only decision makers or influencers in Iraq. When you have dialogues, when you have agreements, sometimes people who are not at the table, who are not signatories to these agreements, have more influence in Iraq on the outcome than the people who signed them from the Iraqi side. And same thing here from the United States. I mean, you know, one tweet or one interview by the U.S. president at the time of the Trump administration, and all bets were off. So you really, I mean, it's both. I agree with Joey, but also both of them, the individuals and the institutions, influence these relations in different ways. Institutions, you need them for the creating and establishing and maintaining positive relations. But individuals, sometimes their role, unfortunately, have been the other way. You know, more on the negative rather than on the positive side.
It's not solely a U.S. question, you know, is important. Because we're looking at U.S.-Iraqi relations, we're talking a lot about, you know, the role that America has played, but the America certainly does not make policy in a vacuum. And certainly Iraqi policymakers in a sovereign country have a vast degree of agency as well. So I'd like to come back to that question. But Assistant Secretary, I'd just like to get your view on the role of individuals before we move on to the Iraqis.
Well, let me just say, just talking about the topic that Dr. Abbas so eloquently addressed there, sometimes the United States can be fully focused on what we want to do with Iraq in terms of everything that I talked about earlier, but it's Iran that imposes itself as a focus of Iraq policy. You know, rockets are getting fired at everybody. Who's that? The Iranian-backed militias. Protesters are getting killed in their hundreds. Who's doing it? The Iranian-backed militias. They're attacking our embassy. Who's doing it? The Iranian-backed militias. You know, they're getting involved in business deals and dumping agricultural products on the market and driving Iraqi farmers out of work. Who's doing it? Of course, the Iranian-backed armed groups and political parties. So, you know, we can't ignore that all of that is happening. We have to take that into account. We have to help Iraqi nationalist institutions and leaders stand up for their country. Why do you think it was a motto of the protesters last year to say, Nurid Watan? You know, they want their own country. They want to be able to make their own decisions and not have that be done from another country. And that's what we're trying to do through our help and our scholarships and our trainings and all of this non-sexy stuff I talked about earlier that doesn't get any headlines at all, which can only be possible if we have that foundation of security and Daesh is not 60 kilometers away from Baghdad threatening everybody.
Thank you. I think, I mean, the question of the Iranian influence here is an important one, and I think we're running out of time slightly on the panel, so we're going to come back to that in the Q&A. I can see it's a significant focus of the question, so we will get there. But Marcin, you know, as I say, we're talking about the sort of the US policymakers, but of course, Iraq also undergoes regular change in its executive. It has a prime minister who's been in for a year now. He'll be up for election in just a few months, we believe. So I wonder, to what extent do you think the individuals at the top of Iraqi politics, at least within the sort of formal structure of the state, right, the prime minister in particular, shapes Iraqi foreign policy? Have there been patterns of continuity, of change from previous premiers? What do you think?
Thank you, Louisa. I think that when it comes to individuals in Iraqi office and Iraqi high office, they aren't able to operate without an agreement, whether direct or informal, with an entire set of political elites who also compose the Iraqi state and who also control significant resources and other governmental offices. So one of the things we've learned from the past few cycles of elections, and one of the things that I'm thinking about as elections are scheduled to occur in October, is that we've seen both the kinds of prime ministers who come from established political parties, and we've seen independent candidates. And one of the things that we're learning from this process is that, unfortunately, when you look at independent candidates, be it Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi or Prime Minister Hadr Abdel Mahdi before him, the lack of a legislative bloc in parliament to support them really cripples them and makes them unable to, particularly with Mustafa al-Kadhimi, unable to really commit to any of the promises that he has made or any things that he was brought into office partly by protesters to do. I mean, if you look at the budget process, if you look at the inability to actually implement economic reform, and most basically, I mean, you see this decline in freedom of speech in Iraq. You see this discriminant violence against activists, and one of the basic demands of the Iraqi street being addressing this, and him being unable to do it, even though in the beginning of his premiership he made an attempt to, but it was quickly brought back and it really never addressed again. And you know, one of the basic goals of this administration, of Mustafa al-Kadhimi's administration, was to address these things, and he has been unable to. And I think a large part of it has to do with the fact that no matter which individual, regardless of whether it's domestic politics or foreign policy, you don't really operate in a vacuum in Iraq. You operate within a network of political elites that you have to navigate. So you're either a strong candidate, even a strong man candidate, or strong man premier, and you get things done, but you get things done at a certain price. Or you're someone like Mustafa al-Kadhimi, who isn't really able to do much but be balanced between different interests. And this applies to foreign policy as well. And I mean, saying all that, I will say, like Assistant Secretary Hood said, there is continuity in terms of high-level frameworks and things like that. It's not all individualistic or all based on administrations. I mean, even in Iraq, if you look particularly at developments of Saudi Arabia, for example, which are very much highlighted these days, they have been a product of various administrations working towards this. I mean, the Saudi embassy in Iraq reopened under Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, who was the first one to do the overtures towards Saudi Arabia, and even Adel Abdel Mahdi attempted the like. So there is some continuity there. But it is really important to remember that, you know, Dr. Abbas Kaldum was saying that the president is increasingly more powerful in the U.S., and that's something we've been talking more about in the U.S. But in Iraq, the prime minister's power does, for a large part, come from the political party and the legislative bloc. So with that, I'll conclude. I think it's our time for, I'm guessing, for the bigger Q&A.
Well, thank you for that, guys. We have some questions coming in. If anyone wants to send them through, they come to events@brookings.edu, or on Twitter, it's #USIraq. If I might just pick up to begin with, and then we'll sort of move on to the audience questions, just on sort of what you're saying, Marcin, about the way in which anyone engages with Iraqi politics no individual decision comes in a vacuum. As you say, there is a network of political elites to be managed. A lot of them are connected. And Assistant Secretary Hood, you know, when you raise the other stuff, the stuff we don't talk about, you know, the building of health institutions, the upgrading of sewage management systems. I guess one thought that comes to my mind is that, you know, the US has done a pretty sterling job at providing, you know, buildings and equipment. But of course, I think what the Ibn al-Khatib fire showed a couple of weeks ago, where 82 people were killed in a coronavirus ward and a big fire ripped through it, is that giving these buildings is one thing, and keeping them going is another. You know, you immediately, the institutions become engaged in a system which is pretty ridden with corruption, with mismanagement. And I guess I wonder how you engage on those issues, right? You can build a hospital, but it's not necessarily the case that the hospital you build will ultimately sort of be able to fill its function as you would like. And I wonder, you know, how the US can engage on these very structural factors.
That's a good question, Louisa. First of all, I think that's where our training programs and our technical advisors can benefit Iraq over the course of years. So someone that we may have sent to training programs or university back in 2005 or 2006, well, now it's 15, 16 years later. These people have taken that expertise, and hopefully they've been that's been recognized, and they've moved up through the Iraqi system so that they're in positions of responsibility. That requires a meritocracy and not a party-based system of, well, you get this ministry and you get that ministry, and it's got to be a really professional civil service. That's not something we can do for Iraq. They've got to have the political leaders need to have the courage to be able to say, nope, we're not going to reward party loyalty. We're going to reward expertise. So that's one thing. Free and fair elections that actually reflect the will of the people, that's the way that you're going to get there. And we have not, you know, seen a perfect example of that yet in Iraq. We hope that it's coming for these early elections in October. We're certainly going to do everything we can. We've allocated millions and millions of dollars to support the United Nations in helping the Iraqis get ready for this election. But I think that's the key. If politicians don't feel that their decisions have consequences, that their mistakes have consequences, well, you'll just be like Lebanon, where, you know, like a gigantic blast can happen in your port and you still don't form a government. You still don't make any reforms because your political future has nothing to do with the actual people. That's what hopefully these elections in October will do, is make the political parties and their leaders directly accountable to the Iraqi people. Then I think you'll see some change. And our people that we've been training and educating and helping and making relationships with for the past 20 years, they'll be ready to help.
Thank you. We have a question from Mara Refkin at Georgetown Law. She says, Iraq will soon start the process of repatriating the more than 30,000 Iraqis believed to be associated with the Islamic State who've been stranded in Al-Hol camp in northeast Syria for years now. I mean, she's asking kind of about, you know, what support can be offered to these people, you know, to the displaced who are coming back from Syria to Iraq. I think, you know, Iraq has largely tried to close its displacement file. As you say, Assistant Secretary, most people have gone home. But these people coming back now are probably among the most stigmatized population among the displaced that we will have seen to date. So I think Mara is asking what can be done. I'll direct this at you, Abbas. What can be done to support these people? And also what can be done to sort of work on the judicial system, the system of trials that some of them will go through when they return or when people they're associated with are arrested?
Well, this is a hot potato for the Iraqi government. In fact, for the international community, not only the Iraqi government. On the one hand, you know, these are people who are, it's a mixed bag. There are people who are involved in criminal activities under ISIS and terrorist activities. And there are people who are captive audience, like children and women and others. Some of the women, of course, are completely innocent. Some of them did perform roles at ISIS. And to sort through that, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of expertise, a lot of resources Iraq doesn't have currently. So that's why I mentioned the international community. So one side is you really need to have an efficient system to integrate them safely, legally, and morally. And put them back into society. The last thing you want to do is to bring a bunch of extremists or terrorists and dump them in the middle of a society that is a post-conflict. But on the other hand, there is another aspect of this, which is really the logistical part of it. You know, it is not just these families in Al-Hol, but also let's remember that Iraq had at one time more than 2 million people who were displaced, and still we have about 1 million displaced people all over Iraq that are unable to go back to their homes and the places where they lived before the crisis. And the bill for that is huge. You have to really rehabilitate the cities and villages and towns where they live. You have to provide an environment where they can come back. Right now, they are provided for in camps. You know, basic life, not really what you hope for any human being, but at least something is provided for them. But if you put them back in these cities, where you know there are no jobs, there are no services, no running water, no electricity. A lot of these areas, probably sometimes up to 80% damage for the infrastructure. And then in many places where they are supposed to go back, the landmines and the ordinances have not been cleared. Some places, you know, there are even dead bodies under the ruined buildings. So this is a huge effort. I'm afraid it's larger than the capacity of the Iraqi government. And Iraq barely is able to run the government and pay the salaries. Where are you going to come up with, you know, up to, depends on whom you ask and what the scope of the rehabilitation and rebuilding, reconstruction, up to $135-150 billion, minimum of $80 billion that you need to make natural or welcoming habitat for these people. So it's really two sides. Mara, I know you are interested in the legal side as a legal scholar, and this is highly important. The security side is highly important, but also I think sometimes it boils down to logistics, because, you know, can you really put them? Is there a place that can welcome them and help them lead a natural life with schools and jobs and markets and safe life, to be honest? And, you know, not to mention the rejection of the locals. You know, there is a stigma on many of these families, and there are tribes that do not want these people back in their areas. So if you put them back in them, probably you really set them as sitting ducks for anybody who would like to shoot them.
Martin, I wonder what you think. Obviously, this is an incredibly thorny issue, not just for, you know, people who want to go home, but also people who are where they came from, people who also themselves have suffered often a vast amount at the hands of the Islamic State. You know, what more can the Iraqi government do to try and get them home? What meaningful support could any external actor offer them?
I mean, I'll provide a broader answer to this, but it's something that's been on my mind the more and more I think about Iraq, is that we truly lack national dialogue and national reconciliation, not just with regards to what happened with ISIS, but even before that. In every crisis we have in Iraq, we tend to just sweep it under the rug and move on and not really provide any resources to victims and not really invest in any dialogue in local communities and try to understand, you know, what it means to be Iraqi, what it means to be oppressed, what it means to be an oppressor. And we've missed our opportunities to do that repeatedly in Iraqi history, in contemporary Iraqi history. And one of the things that I fear with, and I know a lot of members of the international community and a lot of international aid is being directed towards a lot of these discussions about dialogue, particularly at community levels and in smaller levels. And I know there's a lot of energy and a lot of thought that's being worked towards that. And I also know that after the Pope's visit, the Prime Minister did declare a day of national reconciliation and dialogue. So there's a lot of, you know, thoughts and efforts on the periphery percolating about this, but I think it needs to be more sustained and more deliberate, because you can see crises feeding into one another. If someone who had undergone a crisis doesn't really have it addressed or is told to, you know, move on quickly, if there's no resources spent on this, and it really comes back to Iraqi identity and what Iraqi national identity means. And not addressing these issues is part of not really cultivating Iraqi national identity in this time period.
And Assistant Secretary Mona Lisa Friha, I hope I'm saying that right, asks, how does the Biden administration look to the Iranian-Saudi talks in Iraq? Is the US playing any role in it? And how do you think it will affect the tensions in the whole region, including in Lebanon?
Well, thanks for that question. I think Winston Churchill said it best when he said it's better to jaw-jaw than war-war. And of course, as a diplomat, that's what I'm always going to say, that dialogue is better than war up until the last minute. And even during war, you know, it's very important to have open dialogue to try to get things de-escalated. So we support these talks. We don't have anything to do with them, but we certainly support the Iraqi government's outreach and reintegration to all different parts of the region and playing that role as a convener rather than a battleground, as I said earlier. If I may say on El Hol briefly, I think we've lost a lot of time. 2 years ago, we were pressing the Iraqi government to start bringing back at least the people who were in northeast Syria long before Daesh and who ended up in El Hol, the elderly, the sick, the orphans, who were very, very young babies. This could at least reduce the problem by a few thousand and start to get the system working and starting that national dialogue over the need to bring these Iraqi people back home. Unfortunately, that didn't happen at the time. It seems to be happening now, which is good. What the United States is doing to help that, we provided, along with the UK, the first funding for the for UNITAD, the UN commission that is working on investigating possible war crimes. We've provided humanitarian assistance in the form of food and water and medicine to millions of people. The stabilization programs I talked about earlier, demining, we're the largest donor to the country. We fund also reconciliation programs through the U.S. Institute for Peace. We are doing our best. We could always do more, but we're involved in every aspect of trying to help create the conditions for these people to come home and live peacefully. And I think that's what most Iraqis want. You saw it in the visit of the Pope. You mentioned it. He was welcomed by all components of society. People were worried about his security. I wasn't. I said, if there's any problem whatsoever, all the other Iraqis in that crowd will snuff out that person threatening the Pope because they don't want anything to happen here. And I was right.
Marcin, I wonder, two big issues there. You know, on the Iranian-Saudi issue, you know, how do you see, I suppose, the genesis of these talks? How successful can they be? And what does this say about Iraq's role in the region right now? The fact that they're actually here, they were here, doing it in Baghdad.
Well, now we have confirmation from the Iraqi president, though not from any other side, but I think that's confirmation enough for most of us. But like I said earlier, the genesis of these talks, I think, you can trace it back to previous Iraqi administrations creating overtures towards Saudi Arabia and rekindling Iraqi-Saudi relations. Iraq obviously has always had a relationship with Iran, so that was just the other part of the equation. But I also would credit it to personal efforts and personal ties from President Barham Saad and Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. To an extent, that has to be said as well. From what I hear so far, the limitations of these talks revolve around Yemen. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I think it really just puts Iraq in a position where it's mediating in the region about something outside of, you know, its own geographical scope, which actually makes it the definition of mediation when it doesn't really concern you, you're a third party in this. So I think that is a positive sign. I think it's Iraq taking its place in the region. And, you know, Iraq can't be ignored in the region for long. For years, it was a threat to the region under Saddam Hussein. And then after 2003, it became really a state that a lot of other states didn't know quite how to deal with. But I think now it's just falling to its natural position, and that it's a state that has a lot of cultural and religious affinity to most states in the region and can use that to play an important role, which we are seeing right now. I don't know what the outcome politically of these talks will be, but I think regardless of what will happen as a result of them, I think it's setting a precedent of Iraq being a place where these talks can take place.
Thank you. Abbas, I wonder what you think this, you know, Iraq's current role as this sort of either mediator or broker or facilitator says about, you know, the sort of Kadhimi government's emerging foreign policy, how it wants to see itself and perhaps what it actually can achieve as a regional player.
Well, it is a positive thing to see talks, and I agree with Joey and Marcin on that. Talks means that the arms at least will temporarily keep silent, and then we hear the voice of reason or skilled diplomats behind closed doors. You know, they can get angry at each other, but people at least don't get killed, hopefully, while this is happening. Now, most of the misery in the Middle East has been done or caused by the Saudi-Iranian conflict. You know, for more than 5 years, the Saudis have been, waging this atrocious failing war on Yemen. They have not cited one thing that has to do with Yemen, but always they cite the Iranian influence. Bahrain, that has been, you know, the only Arab Spring revolt that was crushed, the only citation was not that the Bahrainis are wrong or their government is wonderful. It's just because they said this is Iranian instigated revolt. Syria has been this also, you know, the Iran and this idea that, you know, to prevent Iran from getting full access or continuous access to the Mediterranean. Iraq has always been the question of Iran-backed militias or this or that. Lebanon is always the same situation. So wherever there is a crisis, wherever people are dying, you know, you really see this is the Iranian-Saudi conflict and its aftermath, and everybody is trying to score points against and the other. And it is very convenient for the Saudis and the Iranians to fight in these wretched places rather than fight it on their own soil and get their own citizens killed. It's immoral. It is wrong. And pretty much, I think I would love to see an international entity that would hold both accountable for every death that they caused. But unfortunately, the way the world works is that, you know, at the end of the day, probably they will get away with it and they will sit. And here we are praising them for sitting and talking after all of the mayhem and death and destruction they have caused. But again, given what the world has to offer us, this is much better option, as ugly as it is, but it is much better option than continuing the conflict. So it is important. I think Iraq has done a good job. Prime Minister Kazem is credited for little because everybody wants his job. So they try to bring him down as much as they can, like with other premiers before him. But I think he deserves a lot of credit for putting these people together. He made several talks. He is one person who can talk and is trusted, both in his previous role as the head of Iraqi intelligence and his current role as a premier. He is trusted by all parties involved, and his series of visits helped create this dialogue. And it is one thing, you know, ironically, he could not get the Iraqi factions to talk to one another, but, you know, he got the Iranians and the Saudis to talk to one another, and hopefully we will have a solution. And this, again, will situate Iraq as a place where people can trust and can see as an honest mediator. Iraq has held before or helped hosted talks between the Americans and the Iranians in the previous nuclear deal. Probably now is able to come back and help both Americans and Iranians speak over Syria, over Saudi, over Iraqi issues as well. So it is a good thing. It's a great sign to see. And we hope that it will be not just talks, but there will be some resolution of some of these issues that have gone madly overdue. And it's time to bury them and come back to sane policy, foreign policy and regional policy within the Middle East.
Thank you. That was a very sort of succinct note on which to end, I think. We are out of time, but I would just like to sort of offer everyone a chance to offer some final thoughts. You know, we've talked a lot today. We've talked about sort of personalities and presidents, peace talks, displacement. We've gone all over the place. So I wonder, you know, Assistant Secretary, to begin with, you know, if you have any concluding remarks, anything you'd like to draw out from the discussion today that you'd like to leave us with.
Well, thank you for having me here. I really appreciate the opportunity, especially so soon, right after getting back from a visit to Iraq. As I said, I think there's a lot of optimism here. The United States clearly is going to remain engaged in the region and in ways that are far beyond just the very important fight against our common enemies in Daesh. So now starts the really difficult work of trying to make sure that everything is in place and all the support that Iraq needs to have free and fair elections in October is done, and that we can help bring those people back home from Syria and integrate them. We can help create opportunities for our business people to create jobs and wealth on in both countries, and so that people can live in peace. That's what we want. That's in the best interest of the United States, and so that's what we're going to work for. Thank you very much for your work, Louisa, reporting on conditions in Iraq. I follow it very, very closely, as well as the academic research that we see from Dr. Abbas and Marcin. Thank you so much. And thanks to Brookings for bringing us together today.
Marcin, any final thoughts? In fact, I can't see
Marcin.
So, Abbas, final
yes.
thoughts.
Well, thank you very much. Hopefully, we'll see Marcin back. I would like to thank her for convening this this timely and important panel. I would like to thank you, Louisa, for always excellent moderation and leading the discussion in a fruitful way. It's so great to see my friend Joey again, and I've seen him in many roles, and I'm glad to see his leadership within the State Department and the U.S. diplomacy. What really gives us a lot of hope is that we are now back to having a very good team leading the United States Middle East policy in the State Department, even in the White House and elsewhere in the Pentagon, has always been people who are working hard to do their best, not without challenges, but, you know, definitely that's great to see U.S. foreign policy and U.S. Iraq policy is back to where we hope it to be. And hopefully they will overturn many of the glitches that were created in the past few years, and we have good trust in that. And again, thank you very much. Thank you for the audience, and I appreciate your invitation. And thanks to Brookings for always doing this great work. Louisa, back to you.
Thank you both, and also to Marcin, who I think has been disconnected, but. I'm very grateful for her thoughts today. It's been a great discussion. Thank you to Brookings for organising this. And thank you to the audience as well for sort of, you know, the sort of panelists and the audience for, you know, bringing in discussion. I think that's not just about this conversation at the role of at the level of geopolitics, but it's also at the discussion at the level of people, you know, at the level of the civilians it impacts. I think that's been fruitful. And thank you. Thanks everyone for watching.
Thank you.